Thank you and welcome to today's teleconference on media company distress. I'm Sam Giordano, ABI Executive Director, and will serve as moderator for the program. The news media is in a troubled state by almost any economic measure. Advertising is off by 25% or more for the second straight year. Newspaper stock values are at historic lows, with many trading at less than $1 a share. Newspaper and magazine profitability is rapidly deteriorating, with some major dailies reporting as much as $1 million a week in losses. Broadcast entities, aside from some cable outlets, aren't much better off. Institutional investors, who typically have a horizon of 12 to 18 months, are fleeing the sector en masse, as even the most optimistic in the media industry can't see a revival within that time frame. A number of major publications are out of business, such as the Rocky Mountain News, or in bankruptcy, such as the Philadelphia Inquirer, Minneapolis Star Tribune, and Chicago Tribune. Even as venerable an institution as Reader's Digest has filed for protection under the bankruptcy laws. Another magazine stalwart, U.S. News and World Report, abandoned the Newsweekly business to focus solely on its popular college ranking guides. The recession has hit advertising revenues the hardest, especially in the formerly lucrative areas of real estate advertising and automobile advertising, while the internet has long since decoupled classified advertising from news. According to the Pew Foundation's annual report on American journalism, the recession at least doubled the revenue losses of the industry in 2008 and swamped efforts to find new sources of revenue. The recession came at a particularly bad time for media companies who loaded up on debt and were heavily leveraged when the financial crash came last year. And even before the recession, the fundamental question facing journalism was whether the news industry could win a race against the clock for survival. Could it find new ways to underwrite the gathering of news online while using the declining revenue of the old platforms to finance the transition? Media companies have had to cut costs deeply and broadly. Newsroom staffs have been cut, salaries frozen, and retirement benefits trimmed. Within the paper, freestanding sections like business are shrinking and increasingly tucked into other sections. Cuts have been made in the physical dimensions of broadsheet papers, both in terms of the weight of the paper and the size of the pages, such as the Chicago Tribune has done in going to a tabloid format for newsstands and newsboxes. Some papers like the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the Christian Science Monitor went exclusively to online-only publication. Home delivery has been cut or outsourced. When trimming operation costs don't work, for many the next recourse is selling assets, everything from land and buildings to prize assets like sports teams, such as the Tribune's attempt to sell the Chicago Cubs. The problem, of course, is that there are few ready buyers and little access to financing to asset sell your way out. Joining us today is a panel of bankruptcy experts to give their insight on media company distress and their thoughts on the future. Our program will run for about 30 minutes, and then we'll take your questions. Our speakers are Sharon Levine, a member of the Bankruptcy Financial Reorganization and Creditors Rights Group at Lowenstein Sandler. Sharon's practice focuses exclusively on bankruptcy, restructuring, debtor-creditor law, and bankruptcy litigation. Her recent representative matters include serving as counsel to the Official Unsecured Creditors Committee in media cases such as Star Tribune and Ion Media. Mark Thomas is a partner in the bankruptcy and restructuring group of Proskauer LLP, where he concentrates his practice on bankruptcies, workouts, and restructuring involving all manner of industries and complex corporate issues. Representative media cases that Mark has worked on include the Philadelphia Newspapers and Ziff Davis Media. And Jason Gold is the chair of Wiley Ryan LLP's Bankruptcy and Financial Restructuring Group, where his practice focuses on major automotive, media, retail, real estate, and telecommunication cases. Jason has represented several broadcast media companies in their financial restructurings. Thank you all to our speakers. Sharon, let me start with you. In your experience in media cases, do the financial problems that we've just identified make these cases more difficult to successfully resolve?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. I think you're dealing with a confluence of problems, including the recession, which is the advertising dollars that are down. But in addition to that, there may be some permanent changes that we're seeing in some of the way people use media and receive their media, particularly with regard to the newspapers. So in both the Star Tribune and in the Sun Times, where we also represented the committee, the issue became whether or not it really was viable to have a daily newspaper or a twice daily newspaper in an era when people are reading their national news on the internet and looking to their paper or their print for local things. Who's getting married? What are your local sports teams doing? What are your kids doing? What are your neighbors doing? So the circulation seems to be down. The advertising seems to be down. And the next generation of users seem to be much more willing to simply look to the internet.
Yeah, Sam, this is Mark Thomas. If I could add to Sharon's answer, you know, what we find in at least the print business is we have a situation where we have falling revenues and fixed costs, and that's a very dangerous combination. The two major sources of revenues are advertising revenues and circulation revenue, and really the question is whether we're in a secular decline or really in a cyclical decline. The circulation revenues have been falling as a younger generation of people no longer buys newspapers and they stick with the internet. Some papers have been able to keep the revenue fairly steady at the circulation line by increasing prices, but there is an erosion of people that are reading the papers. The advertising revenue is just falling across the board. You know, the real question is, have we seen the bottom, or is 2010 going to be as bad as 2009 in terms of deteriorating revenues? There have been some hopeful signs from some of the big players, New York Times, McClatchy, and the like, that they may be bottoming out on the loss in revenue. But when you think that historically most of the advertising revenue came from classified, which is now pretty much all internet, automotive, which has its own problems, retail, which has its own problems, and real estate, which has its own problems, you can understand how the revenue has been falling off a cliff for these print institutions. And then you've got fixed costs because you have an overwhelmingly union-based workforce who have contracts that have been negotiated over years and years. And in addition to those union agreements, in many cases, many of the old line newspapers have defined benefit pension plans that are part and parcel of those union contracts, and those defined benefit pension plans have become woefully underfunded due to the loss of value of the assets in those plans.
So we've identified a lot of problems, economic problems that you're going to confront when you have the task of trying to reorganize the finances of media companies. What can a debtor do in the face of not only the overwhelming web competition and the economic downturn, but some of the other issues that we talked about? What strategies can work?
Well, this is Jason Gold. As you alluded to earlier, Sam, many of the media companies, particularly on the broadcast side that I'm more familiar with, are still embarking on major cost cutting programs, similar to how the newspapers are doing that in their own way. The media, the electronic media, while we see that there are certainly a certain amount of union penetration, it's not nearly as ubiquitous as you see in the publishing side. But nevertheless, the cost side of it is a major focus. Additionally, what's being attempted is to leverage technology in such a way. For example, with radio stations, this has been going on really for many, many years, but it's perhaps accelerating, where certain stations can share content even more so than they have in the past, and do it in such a seamless and technological way that It's not noticeable. It's not the same as the old radio networks that we've seen, but almost where the programming is virtually the same in stations that may extend over state lines, for example. However, this is a double-edged sword because we know that in the long run, for radio stations to remain viable, or the radio station industry to remain viable, there has to be local content. There has to be local programming. Otherwise, people simply are not going to listen. People, it's believed, want to hear the local weather, for example. They want to hear about local sports teams. They want to hear about local government sometimes, at least. So, again, that's a double-edged sword. What else are they doing? They're, of course, trying to restructure debt with more and more cooperation, I think, from the large institutional lenders. Certainly lower interest rates, in spite of the tight credit environment, lower interest rates and the higher cap rates are certainly helping somewhat, and I think will help even more so going into next year and the year after. But we are seeing some signs of loosening of credit. But those are really some of the things that are going on. I seem to think, though, that we may have hit bottom. If you think about it, certainly automobile advertising, which we know, as Mark indicated, is way, way, way down, that will increase as the automobile industry itself gets back on its feet, and we've seen some indications that the industry is improving. Additionally, housing, residential housing, which is another big component of advertising throughout all media, is probably improving, so that will help somewhat. But there's no question that values are down and will stay down for quite some time.
Mark or Sharon, do you have any thoughts on strategies that financially distressed media outlets can use in this environment?
One of the things that we saw in both the Star Tribune and in ION Media is conversion of debt to equity and lightening the fixed cost by lightening the debt load. And hopefully as the economy comes back, those that took the debt to equity conversion will actually be able to realize an upside as opposed to trading at par, which I think is something that indicates that there's some investor interest back in the sector, which has probably been a good thing.
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, it seems like the way out is through a massive deleveraging. I mean, the industry, at least on the print side, faces a couple problems. I mean, we need to implement financial restructurings. The industry has completely out of whack balance sheets, way too much debt. But operational restructurings also have to be implemented because there are operational challenges that the papers have to adapt to. In terms of what can the debtor do to raise revenue, I mean, the entire industry is challenged in terms of trying to get money for content and make money off of dot-com properties. And that model has not yet really been proven. I think it's coming around, but it is still very challenging for the people that are creating the content to get value out of it. They're selling and disposing of non-core assets. And the other thing is to try to really target their customers, their advertisers, to show why their advertising dollars are better spent on a newspaper, which does reach and touch a lot of people. It's amazing how many people that I talk to, given my representation of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News, who are of my generation, who read a paper every day, talk about how they like the paper. They want to feel the paper. They want that tangible paper. Although they'll get something off the internet, they still like the tangibility of the paper. On the cost side, they just have to come up with creative ways and hopefully consensual ways to address labor costs, benefits, and then their principal inputs are paper and ink, and those are commodities. And then if they delever it, maybe they can get away without overburdening the capital structure.
Thanks. Who are the typical creditors in a media case, and How do they behave differently, if at all, from the other types of restructurings that you've been involved in?
What we've seen on a lot of the creditors committee is that you have a very mixed creditor body, and it includes the trade creditors, though, tend to be focused on long-term content providers with much more of an interest in the go-forward business plan of the company and the structural integrity of a go-forward business plan, because they want to enter into long-term contracts the same way the company would like to enter into long-term contracts. In addition to that, you see the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp, to the extent that there's large pension exposure, and you often have one or two unions on the committee along with the indenture trustee and debt holders. An interesting twist also that we saw in the Star Tribune was because the company was viewed as so far underwater, the first lien debt was viewed as the fulcrum or the likely only collateralized debt. The second lien debt, which originally thought they had a secured position, actually was invited to serve on the creditors committee when all of the parties acknowledged that they were no longer collateralized. And then the debt below that in the capital structure was also invited to sit on the committee. But you have what would historically have been treated as secured creditors now actually serving as part of your unsecured creditor constituents.
Are creditors, by and large, do they get it? Are they being reasonable in these cases, or do they have an unrealistic expectation about the debtor's ability to reorganize?
I don't want to touch that one.
I know you've got a live case there, Mark. So
yeah, I don't want to touch that one.
No, I'll go
historically. Okay, go ahead, Jason.
No, I was going to say, I think on balance, lenders in particular, the institutional lenders that hold the large paper, the large debt, are being reasonable, and they don't necessarily act in a completely rational way, but they do see the same issues that we've been discussing, and a lot of the issues come down to what happens on the other side. When you come out of the restructure, how do you best accomplish it? But in terms of the values, I think for the most part, in their heart of hearts, they know that these values are greatly, greatly depressed, and the rest is just detail.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think the parties are really, really fighting over value. They're sort of fighting over what's the optimal capital structure, on emergence, and what's going to, you've got the tension between, the company that wants to really, really have a delivered capital structure so it can emerge and be viable. And in a lot of situations, the lenders that want to convert their debt to equity want to maintain quite a bit of debt on the company to protect themselves. And that's just a tension that's hard to work through.
Jason, in the broadcast media environment, of course, there's another major player who isn't, at least currently, a big factor in the print cases, and that's the government, in terms of government licensing. So I take it that those government licensing issues add to the complexity of a financial restructuring of a broadcast entity.
No question, Sam. First of all, you have the possible savior of last resort in our economy among various industries, we all know, has been foreign ownership or these sovereign funds and the like. We saw, it wasn't a sovereign fund, but we saw the Fiat company, of course, come in and play a role in the Chrysler case. But when you have a broadcast regulated media companies, you have very strict rules against foreign ownership. So many of the broadcast companies are just really precluded from looking overseas. The rule is very simple. Foreign ownership can't exceed 25% of the equity, nor can't hold more than 33% of the debt of a licensed American media, radio station or television station, to be precise. So you have that limitation, but you also have what you just mentioned, the ownership limits, what we call the cross ownership limits, or the or the concentration limit. For example, one rule which is pretty fundamental is that one entity may not own both a commercial broadcast station and a daily newspaper in the same community. And so you have that simple rule which will tend to constrain commerce within the ability to sell a licensed station or a licensed broadcaster. Sometimes you may, sometimes you see that you have the wherewithal to do that, but it just can't be done for that reason. And then there are other much more complex rules with respect to within the industries themselves, so that, for example, there are only so many TV stations or radio stations that one company can own within a particular market, irrespective of the newspaper side of it. And the real problem is that these rules predate the Internet. I mean, they really, a lot of these rules go back to the 1980s or even earlier. There's been all kinds of litigation over the years where the media companies have fought the FCC on this. The FCC, has come up twice with edicts which have been knocked down by federal courts, which have sent them back to the drawing board, and really nothing meaningful has come out of that in terms of change or modernization of these rules. So, you have this overarching problem of federal regulation, which is just simply not up to date.
I want to open it up to our members of the media who are on the call, but I wanted to ask one last question for the group. Jason alluded to this in terms of the government issue of the public interest, and again, perhaps unique to the media business, there is a kind of public interest component. The news media historically exists in part to serve the public, to serve as a kind of public watchdog and the like. And if they disappear in one form or another, at least traditional forms, there could well be an impact on the public. Should the courts consider this public interest dimension when they're handling these cases and deciding issues within the case about keeping media companies alive? Or is it strictly a matter of making the economic numbers work? Mark, Sharon, any thoughts on the public interest dimensions of these media cases?
Yeah, I guess I'll start out briefly. I think the courts should consider the community as part of the public interest. You know, in a lot of situations, we talk to boards of directors about what their fiduciary duties are and to whom they owe fiduciary duties. And we tell boards in situations that they owe their duties to a community of interest. And these are special institutions. They report facts as well as have editorial opinion. And it is a needed watchdog over public servants, governments, and other institutions. And, you can think historically of all the stories that have come to pass that have uncovered, major crises in America. And it happened because of reporting. And I don't know that blogging is going to fill the role without sort of editorial checks and balances over reporters. So I think the community interest should be taken into consideration by the courts in these restructurings.
Sharon, do you agree with that?
This is Sharon. The answer is I think yes. And I've seen some of the judges actually take into account whether or not the community that's being served by the particular debtor is also being served by other news outlets, because if not, they're very cognizant of the fact that there should be a, reliable news source that makes its way into these communities.
Great. Let's open it up to our media members who are on the call. If you can just state your name and your question, we can have our bankruptcy experts address your questions directly.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone. If you're joining us using a speakerphone, we ask that you please release your mute function to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, star 1, please. And we'll go first to Marianne Milburn with the Orange County Register.
Yes, I was just wondering if you guys could speak to the fact that it looks like J.P. Morgan is going to own most of the media industry when this is all said and done, and how that plays out, because I understand there are certain constraints on banks in terms of owning any companies, much less media.
Well, this is Mark Thomas. I don't know that J.P. Morgan is going to own most of the media industry. I do know that they are the agent in many of these media cases. And as agent, they are the sort of spokesperson for the debt holders. But I don't know off the top of my head the actual amount of debt that they hold in each one of these cases that's pending. But that is clearly something that, you know, Jason was talking about the regulatory issues. It is curious to see whether or not it would be appropriate to have, you know, a financial institution that has borrowed money from the federal government then be in control of major news outlets.
Aha. Uh-huh. I mean, you can easily see how that might spin out. I mean, you can easily see the government getting more involved in a major media case, much like it has in, you know, auto and financial services, either deciding that a particular media player is too important, if not too big, to fail because of these public interest issues we talked about, or because of the fact of the government money. Once the government gives the banks the money to inject back into the economy, obviously with that money can come a number of strings attached, which could dictate how that creditor participates in the bankruptcy case. I don't think that's too far-fetched. Does anyone else?
Well, I can't comment on J.P. Morgan directly because we're involved in that case, but the concept is a scary one, such that the government would somehow be picking, you know, put it bluntly, winners and losers in the media space. I think there's just significant implications with respect to First Amendment rights and free speech, and just the whole idea of the government being involved in media. It's fairly un-American.
Are there other questions from our media guests?
Not at this time, but once again, star one, please.
Let me follow up with our panel on one of the other issues related to labor in these cases. The media sector is pretty heavily unionized, particularly on the print side. Everything from newsrooms to press operations to the people who drive the trucks to deliver the papers. And in a bankruptcy situation, if you want to modify or otherwise abrogate a collective bargaining agreement, you've got to go through Section 1113 or 1114 of the bankruptcy code. Have our panel had much experience in determining whether or not those existing structures for renegotiating labor agreements are working in these media cases, or should there be some, perhaps even adjustment to the statute to make them more adaptable to media labor agreements?
Well, this is Mark Thomas. I don't think this statute should be adapted to reflect one industry versus another. I think what you have seen and what you will continue to see is that entities that are considering filing for a reorganization that might need to restructure their union contracts will carefully research what forum is best suited for restructuring union contracts. And it's one of the typical due diligence items we undertake. We see what various venues we can file in, and we try to research precedential law that might be favorable to us in terms of whatever issue we're going to face. And I think that is happening in some of these media cases right now.
Speaking of venue, do you think you could file one of these newspaper cases in a venue other than the district where the paper's located? I mean, obviously you could, but do you think that as a strategy would be wise when you're picking a forum?
Yeah, this is Jason. I think you've hit on something important, Sam. The idea of venue forum shopping has always been you know, near and dear to the hearts of lawyers, whether they be litigators or bankruptcy lawyers. But when you have a media company, a radio station, TV station, a newspaper that is in a community, All other things being equal, I think you certainly do want to file the case in that local community. Of course, there are many other considerations, such as the state of the law, because we know that the law varies with respect to cram down and other types of issues around the country, and also with respect to the judge that you might draw. But I do think it's important in terms of the home court advantage that you want to select the court where your media property is located, if at all possible.
Jason, this is Sharon. I find that interesting, actually, because the cases that we've been involved with have all been in Delaware or the Southern District. Ion Media in the Southern District, Pappas Telecom, and sometimes in Delaware, and then the Star Tribune in the Southern District. And yeah. Our sense was that it wasn't necessarily the local flavor, but the case precedent that was referred to earlier as important drivers for the debtor in making those decisions.
Yeah, and really, Sharon, I think I had in mind the smaller cases where certainly the ones I've been involved in, more so than the larger cases, it has, I think, at least the sense has been to file or threaten to file in the home court, so to speak.
Was there a question from one of our media guests on the line? Okay. If not, let me ask another question of the group. A number of papers have adopted joint operating agreements to keep at least one paper open in cities that formerly had two, as a way to try to save costs while maintaining separate editorial boards and policies and the like. Do you do our faculty see that as becoming more popular or prevalent as a way to kind of reduce costs and keep the media companies open? Sharon or Mark?
This is Sharon. The in the case specifically of the Star Tribune, where the Pioneer Press was the other newspaper, it was our understanding that the debtor did actually spend a lot of time investigating whether or not a joint operating agreement would have been workable through the Chapter 11 process. It looks like their use is more frequently used in connection with an out-of-court restructuring than once you actually find yourself in a Chapter 11 process. And our understanding is that in addition to the intricacies of dealing with the two companies, there are also intricacies in dealing with the government oversight that may make it less of a useful tool than it had originally been thought to be.
I mean, it's fair to note, I suppose, that those were tried and they didn't exactly help in the case of Denver or Seattle, where the papers ended up failing anyway, notwithstanding the efforts at cost savings through joint operating agreements. They may be more trouble than they're worth, in terms of combating the economic reality of the economic issues that we talked about. Are there any other questions from our media guests?
Once again, that is star one, please.
If not, on behalf of the ABI, we want to thank those who've called in or listened in to the program. And we especially want to thank our speakers, Sharon Levine, Mark Thomas, and Jason Gold, for joining us for this excellent program. Those on the call who want to follow up with any of the speakers, we encourage you to do so through our public affairs manager, John Hartkin, at 703-739-0800 for more information. And with that, on behalf of the ABI, this is Sam Giordano saying good day.